not gravity. What's happening is you are coupling to ground. Coupling to ground can produce a whole bunch of different things. In some cases, the ground absorbs the energy and you've lost it and you've diminished the efficiency and parts of the radiation pattern are just swallowed up. In other cases, some of the energy is not totally absorbed but reflected back at the opposite direction. And so you have a non-vertical incident sky wave, a cloud warmer that you don't want. You know, if you, that's the reason why if you have a horizontal center fed that's too close to the ground, you're only going to communicate locally because of the massive absorption and reflection will end up, most of the energy will be going straight up, and you might get a little bleed through around there, but it's certainly not going to take off on the ionosphere and propagate across the world.
Okay, so I just simply said, let's say the antenna, you think of it as just a wire, okay? It's the physical relationship to the ground, the physical positioning, right, of the antenna to the ground that dictates the takeoff angle. So is there less coupling if that wire is situated vertically? Is that what it is, less coupling to the ground than if it was situated horizontally?
Generally speaking, yes. Also, it has to do with the distance. That's why radials of verticals come in very different numbers. If you ever look at a person's vertical mounted on his roof, very often the radials are just three or four wires. If you ever see a vertical mounted on the ground, you are probably looking at 30, 40, maybe even 50 radials. The reason is because of the coupling is so severe as a ground-mounted vertical that without enough radials to reflect the power back up, it will get sucked into the soil. You have that problem with verticals that are close to the ground. If you get them a little higher, there's a lot less to be worried about. When you flip them 90 degrees, and some of the radiation is already going to be emitted downward, you're kind of stuck. So you have to get it much higher. There's no way of kind of shielding the ground from the local coupling of a horizontally oriented antenna close to the ground.
Okay, it's time for the space report. So that means next week I'll ask this question, and I'm sure you could predict it's coming. So why does a magnetic loop throw out all these laws that pertain to every other kind of antenna? It's an interesting concept. Anyway, thanks, Roy. I'll see you on the TechNet next week.
Enter exchange with the question.
Yes, Wesley?
Okay, it's going to be kind of uncommon. Does the dog have a self-consciousness?
I do not know. Now, if you talk to a dog psychologist, they'll probably say yes. And I'm sure I could find you other guys who will say no. But I think the most honest is I don't know. Animals have less cognitive power than most human beings I know. So it's kind of difficult to figure out how much animals other than us are like us. There have been some studies where they supposedly taught a gorilla to sign language and had conversations. There are many people who believe that that's not really, it's a poor interpretation of what went on, and there was no indication that the gorilla actually understood the concepts, but simply used mimicry to get fed and other things that it wanted. So I would love to give you a definitive answer, but I cannot. They certainly seem to mimic these qualities, but how much and in what ways they are similar and or different to us is yet to be discerned.
So self-awareness and self-consciousness are mainly features of the human animal, but other animals have it too, at least for mammals group. So the question is, actually, it's a problem in science that ideas and assumptions must be demonstrated. And dog does it too. So what is the major difference between human, animal, and dog, or another mammal?
Well, I mean, yes, Jeff?
Best ask, Mark Twain.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean there's an old, an ancient Greek concept called qualia. And the bottom line is, because I see a color and I call it green, is my internal representation of the color green the same as yours? I don't know. You don't know. There's no way to tell. So, you know, in severe cases of people just want to get on your nerves, there's no ultimate proof that the rest of humanity is conscious the same way you are, because you can't look inside them. So maybe we're all automatons and you're the only self-aware conscious life form in the universe.
Okay. So coming back to the question, what is the major difference between human animals and other mammals?
They have different DNA, they have different shapes, they have different motivations in many ways. Their cognitive, their memories, their way of looking upon things. You can even look upon it as a baby's developing. You know, there's a certain point where when newborns, when something goes behind a curtain for newborns, it tends to, they perceive it as having ceased to exist. And when it comes out the other end, it suddenly exists again. And there's a certain age that toddlers can actually figure out that the damn thing has just gone behind the cover, and they should look for it at the other end. So even in the brain development in human beings, there are stages. So at what stage other animals are capable of reaching is different for different animals. Very, you know, I mean, birds kind of talk. Whales communicate with each other. So there's aspects of things that we kind of take for granted. There are animals that learn to use tools. They make tools and they use them. So, you know, the differences between the species intellectually is not a kind of a sharp edge, but a kind of a fuzzy edge. So, you know, it's an interesting field, and it's really early on in its investigation. So I wish I could give you a more thorough presentation on the subject, but it just doesn't exist yet.
Okay, so when we compare a child to gorillas in terms of manifesting a similar form of or similar level,
well, you know, I mean, there are guys out there who will kind of say that parrots are basically at a kind of human level of 8 months or something. I don't know where they draw these conclusions. I think they pulled them out of the backside. So, I think, unfortunately, we don't even have a good set of words to explain the concepts that we're trying to look at. Because, you know, babies are not animals at certain ages. I mean, you know, how young a baby would have to be to, in your mind, being intellectually similar to an adult Doberman Pinscher? I don't know how you kind of come up with that solution to that equation.
So you say that some of humanoidal mammals do not have a brain power to learn the way the child learns. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, actually, infants have more brain cells than we do. It's not that they grow brain cells as they get older. It's that their brains get organized. They're plastic. They get organized, and a lot of necessary nerve cells die off. So it's not simply that. You know, babies pop out of the womb with the brains of a dog, and as they get older, they have the brains of animals with higher cognitive skills. You know, it's kind of apples and oranges. It's not something like, they used to have the old incorrect notion that embryology, embryos go through every evolutionary stage. And they fudge the images of embryos to kind of indicate that we start out as fishes and we go on to this and we go on to that and we're birds. That's not real. They kind of fudge the data. This was back in the 1800s. And it just took a long time to kind of extract that from nonsense. So none of this is simple. I wish it was simple, because simple things are easy to explain. And also, I think we should wrap this up soon, because I don't want poor Paul to have to wait anymore for the SpaceNet report.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ray. It was very much interesting talking to you about it. And to you.
Thank you. Likewise, Wesley. Well, thanks, everyone. I'll be back a little bit later on, but now it's time for the SpaceNet report with Paul WS2N.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N. And what were you on? Were you on All-Star tonight, or what were you transmitting with?
Yeah, this is All-Star. It has one little gotcha. Sometimes during the 3 hours, it just kind of drops the audio. So that's when you no longer hear me, and I don't realize that I'm not being heard. So I have to turn it off and turn it on. I don't hear any of the chirping, the IDing, any of those things. I look at the waveform. And one really nice benefit is that I know exactly when someone's doubling, because I hear it simultaneously. In the old days with the RF, I wasn't able to listen. So I know immediately when someone's talking over me, and so I shut up.
Yeah, I like that too. You know, I hear the same thing. Very good. It's really the way to go. I mean, it's just like night and day compared to what used to be. I remember a lot of times, you know, we would lose, you know, half the net because of problems, you know. But now, boy, just terrific. Very good, Roy.
Yeah. I mean, there was one time a couple of months ago, work at the very beginning, and I shifted over to RF, and fortunately the reception was decent. So it's not 100% perfect, but it's very nice when it's working.
Okay, sounds good, and literally sounds good. Very good. Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. I just want to go over a few things here. We did this last couple of weeks, and then took up a lot of time, but we did a lot of fill-in time for the TechNet. But it's good to have Roy back. Anyway, tonight the space station went right over my house. It was just terrific. I went out at 7:30, 7:31 exactly. 7:31 and 15 seconds. It appears in the northwestern sky this time and goes right over the house. And then exits to the east, to the southeast. I use the ISS detector. It's an app. I've been using it for years, and it works very well. And it will even give you a 5-minute warning of when it's going right over your location. And they naturally put the location in, and it really works quite well. Tonight was very bright path. They'll even tell you the magnitude of the light. In this case, it was minus 4. The lower the number, the brighter it is. So if minus 4 is much brighter than a minus 1, for instance. When you're up to minus 2.5, all the way up to 4, minus 4.5, something like that, it's extremely bright, and it's really worthwhile watching. It's really cool to go out knowing exactly when it appear, where it's going to appear, and that type of thing. And there's a couple of other passes that are going to be happening, but the next bright pass, I think it's a magnitude 3.5. which is about as bright as it was tonight, will be on the 3rd, a couple days from now, on the 3rd. Again, right around 7:30. But it's a good app. You don't have to worry about all this advertisement and everything. It never locks up on you. The ISS detector app. All right, let me see if anybody has any comments. I will move on to the next topic. This is WS2N. I don't know if Chris is on frequency, K2STP, but he sent me a very good YouTube. Let me just stand by. Maybe he's out there. Okay. Anyway, but what it is it's not long. It's maybe about 8 minutes long or so. But it's all about the relative distance between, let's say, the sun and the earth and all the different planets. And, what he does is, in this YouTube, they lay it out on a football field. They'll put the sun at one end, and then they'll use the earth. The earth is like the size of a marble. It looks like he used a marble, around a half inch in diameter. And he created one AU, a certain distance from that. From the sun, AU is astronomical unit. So from Earth to the sun, it's one. And then he put Mercury in there, point three or something. And then he had Venus in there at a certain distance. And he started laying these little marbles or similar, it's close to marble form anyway. Very like he's like a P, for Mercury, and then he went further out with Mars, then out to the outer planets, and by the time he got up to Neptune and eventually Pluto, it was way out there. I mean, way past the 300-foot mark, that's for sure. And then he said, looking at the size of Earth, if you were going to use the actual half-inch size, the distance that he just laid out on a football field was way off, actually. If you're going to use that half-inch size as that dimension, Pluto, instead of, where you put it, would actually be about 7 miles away. 7 miles away. That shows the amount of space that's located between these things. So I thought about it after he sent it to me, and I did the rough math of where Proxima Centauri would be, the Alpha Centauri system, which is the nearest star system to our solar system. And I came out with a really bizarre number. By the time you figure it all out, how many AUs there are, and going all the way out to Alpha Centauri, or I use the distance between the Sun and Pluto, which is really 39 AU, so roughly 40. I took that number and figured out how many distances between the Earth and from Earth, from the Sun to Pluto. How many of those distances would be all the way to Alpha Centauri? And I came out with some 6,000, almost 7,000. And then if you you continue to do the math of where that would really be located on this guy's scale, using the Earth as a half-inch diameter scale, where that would be. And it came out to like 48,000 miles. You'd have to go out. It would need a rocket ship to put Alpha Centauri where it needed to be on this scale. So it's quite good. When I hear from Principal, maybe we can get that website put up onto Roy's website. Anybody wants to look at that? This guy explains it very well. Plus, he gives a lot of other scientific data. Talking about tremendous amount of space that's between the planets and especially the stars. Let me drop it. WSON.
Paul?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just a great quote that I know from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's supposed to be in the actual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the book in the book. It says space, it says, is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space.
It really is. That's why, you know, they talk about, you know, these satellites hitting each other. It's not that easy. And they're close in compared to, you know, when we go further out. But it's mind-boggling. On my wall, one of these days I'll take a picture of this. I have a picture of the universe, and they have different, you know, starting from the Earth, you know, solar system, and then it keeps going up. It goes to the galaxy, and then the local stars. It gets bigger and bigger, and eventually, you know, to the whole universe. It's really quite a good thing. I'll take a picture of it one day and send it over to you. You can put that on the website as well. Amazing. When you look at something like that, back to your world.
Well, yeah, I mean, and also you should keep in mind that that's probably only the observable universe, because we can only see the portion that's within our light cone that hasn't gotten farther away than the speed of light can reach us. So there's a much bigger unobservable universe that's bigger than the observable one. So go figure that one.
And the portion traveling backwards in time.
The first satellite we have now is the spacecraft, is the Voyager 1, you know, and that's, I think it's around 160 somewhat. Maybe 100, almost 170, I guess, astronomical units. Then it takes 37 hours round trip, something like that. Roughly 18, I think it's 18 hours one way. Anyway, if you make a transmission now at the speed of light, you know, you have to wait about a day, almost a day and a half before you get an answer to find out if the spacecraft is okay. And that is only, you know, maybe three or four, I think it's three and a half times the distance of Pluto. Now, you can imagine, you know, all the way to Alpha Centauri. Alpha Centauri, or Proxima Centauri, is actually the closest star, but in the Alpha Centauri system, 4.2 light years. So now, in this day and a half, now this thing's been traveling since, what, 1977, when it was launched on a Centaur rocket from Earth. And it takes, you know, from almost now 2 days, one day there, one day back, let's figure. It'll be like that someday in the near future. You know, 2 days round trip. Could you imagine for a month or a year, about 4 years, how about 4.2 years at that speed, of light, just to get to Alpha Centauri? You know, incredible distance. I don't think we'll be getting there anytime soon anyway.
No, not unless you have the plans for a warp drive engine in your back pocket.
Very good. Yeah, Thank God for TV shows. That's the only way. That's the only way we're going to get there. All those science fiction shows. Okay. Well, I'm talking about going far distances. You have the launch of Psyche. Psyche mission, which is going out to an asteroid with the same name, Psyche. And that's going to be launching very soon. Today's what, October 1st? So this thing is like 11 days away, October 12th. They pushed it back a few days. They had some technical problems they needed to, mechanical problems they needed to work on the spacecraft a little bit. This thing's going to be going out to Psyche, which is out in the asteroid belt. Past Mars, you know. And then the goal is to go into orbit around Mars. That is, it won't get there until like 2029. Here we are, roughly 6 years it will take to get there. The large spacecraft, and because of the distance and the weight of this thing, they're going to use SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket, which is. It's about as much thrust as what the shuttle launch system used. A little over five, I think it's around 5.5. I believe 500,000, probably over that. I would say 5.5 million pounds of thrust. We'll push this thing all the way to the asteroid belt. And go to the asteroid Psyche. It's an all metal, solid metal type of asteroid that they want to visit. They think it could be leftover core from a planet that tried to develop that never happened. So now it's not that big. It's around 140 miles in diameter. So a little longer than the distance from Montauk Point, I guess, to the middle of New York City to Columbus Circle. That's probably 120 miles or so, and this is 140 miles in diameter. And this thing will orbit this thing for a couple of years. It doesn't have a sample return mission on it, but it will take detailed spectrum. It's going to figure out what the thing is made of and the percentage and all that. Scientists will love to get this back. One of the interesting experiments they do have on board is this optical system, this laser system that they're going to use. The idea is to transmit a signal from Earth all the way out to the asteroid belt, when it gets there. They plan on transmitting an optical system with 5,000 watts from Earth, and that by the time this laser infrared light gets to Psyche should be able to pick it up, and it will hone in on exactly where Earth is located. Not only where Earth is located, but where the transmitter is located. In this case, they're going to use two locations: one in California, and I think the other one in New Mexico. And then once it figures out where the transmitting stations are, it's going to use its own laser, which only puts out, like, I think they said 4 watts of power to transmit back. But, knowing that the exact location where it is, that 4 watts of power will be able to be picked up by the receiver on Earth. They're going to use, the Hale telescope. Pick up the signal from Psyche. Anyway, this is an experiment. They hope to get anywhere between 10 and 100 times the amount of data back from an optical system like this compared to RF, which eventually, let's say you go to Mars, which is a lot closer to the asteroid belt. Asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter. So let's say you're on Mars, you might not need as much power to do it, but you could be transmitting back to Earth a tremendous amount of data that's going to be necessary years from now, whenever we settle the settled that planet, Mars will be able to be, you know, eventually a base. So you'll need to send not only data back and forth, even video. So, to be able to do that. I mean, as it is now, just sending any kind of pictures back to Earth from Mars, if you want to send a video back, it takes a tremendous amount of bandwidth. They just took a, let's call it a video, but all it is a lot of different frames of a dust devil on Mars with Perseverance. So what it did, it took one of its navigation cameras, those are black and white cameras, and shot different frames, roughly 1/20th of a second apart, and put them together, sent them back to Earth, and sure enough, you can see in the distance this dust devil moving across the surface. They said it was like 2.5 miles away. And tremendous cameras that are on board Perseverance on that rover. But, you know, you could imagine. Now, this whole process to get that data back took forever. Using RF, what they do is Perseverance sends a UHF signal up to the orbiting spacecraft. In this case, it was Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And then from there, they turn around on that spacecraft, and they transmit back on the X-band all the way back to the Deep Space Network, and they pick it up with these, you know, 200-foot diameter dishes, and then from there, they eventually send it to NASA, you know, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, in this case, to decode everything. But imagine doing this with optical. I think that would be great, and we'll see how that experiment goes. Let me drop it. Talking about these optical transmissions, they have a launch going up, actually 1 month from now, November 1st. It's going to launch on a Falcon 9 rocket, and they call it CRS-29. And what that is, it's the 29th launch of cargo to the International Space Station. SpaceX supplies not only astronauts to the International Space Station, but they supply cargo as well. And on board this thing, they're going to send something called Integrated Laser Communications Relay Demonstration Low Earth Orbit User Modem and Amplifier Terminal. Anyway, they call it a LLUMA, LLUMA-T. Now, this thing is going to be attached to the International Space Station. What they're going to do is they're going to transmit from Earth on, using optical, again, infrared laser. They're going to be able to transmit all the way up to a geosynchronous satellite that also has a similar optical system on board. And what they're going to do is they're going to actually have communications with NASA astronauts once this whole thing is set up. You know, space station will be able to transmit up to the geosynchronous satellite 23,000 miles away will transmit down to New Mexico, and they'll pick up the signal and vice versa. And they're going to test this out to see if they can have some kind of communication from the video or data, or both. They're going to see if they could increase their amount of data that goes back and forth, either 10 to maybe 100 times, depending on how this all works out. But it'll be a big improvement over the TDRS system. TDRS system's all RF right now, and that, they do the same similar thing when they transit. You know, you're looking at videos of the astronauts on station, either a spacewalk or an interview. Again, it's all RF being transmitted up to the TDRS satellites, the Tracking and Data Research Relay satellites. And geosynchronous orbit, and they transmit back down to Earth, vice versa. That's what they're doing now. So basically, you're creating a new type of teacher satellite with optical capabilities, which will be quite good. The unit on board the geosynchronous orbital satellite is actually part of another, I think it's a military satellite. It's some 8,000-10,000 pounds when they go up there, and NASA took a piece of that one satellite because it was going to geosynchronous orbit, the power, and they were able to have this optical laser system. All they need is one more launch, and that will be November 1st. Any comments? WS2S. Okay, I know we talk about SpaceX with their Starlink system. Some over 5,000 satellites now are orbiting Earth. And the astronomers, of course, are not happy about that. There's another group called OneWeb, and I think they have about 500 to 600 satellites using their broadband system. These things are, all internet service. We're all familiar with the Starlink system, especially if you watch the news. They're involved with the Ukraine and all. They have 1.5 million customers signed up with them. OneWeb is also signing up people now for their system. They only have around 600 satellites. But coming up a couple of days from now, I think it's October 6th, the Kuiper satellite system by Amazon. They want to put, not 600 up, but at least 3,000 or 4,000 satellites. That's their goal. They wanted to do this for quite a while, but some of their launches that they had planned on using are delayed. They plan on using the Vulcan rocket, and that hasn't made its first flight yet. They hope that Boeing will get that thing off the ground by the end of the year. Boeing and Lockheed are building the Vulcan rocket to replace the Atlas V, and they actually signed up many contracts with Boeing to use the Vulcan rocket to put their hundreds and eventually thousands of satellites up. And then they're also contracted with the European Space Agency. They plan on using their new Ariane 6 rocket, which hasn't gone up yet. So we're working with the Ariane 5. Ariane 6 should have gone up by now, but they had delays. So Amazon really doesn't want to wait anymore, so what they're doing is they're going to actually send this thing up on a Boeing Lockheed Atlas V rocket. And this will be just a couple of satellites, really more or less to test it out. Just a couple. Anyways, the first of many, many launches. I think it's 60 launches or so they're going to be needing over the next couple of years. SpaceX and OneWeb will eventually have another competitor in the broadband service of space. Any comments? An astronaut came back last week. You might have seen that on the news. That usually makes the news when they're up there for so long. Frank Rubio came back. I talked about this last week. Now he's back, successful. Came through the atmosphere with two Russians on a Soyuz descent vehicle. Everything went well. They separated from the International Space Station. And within hours, they eventually deorbit and come back to Earth. Right before they enter the atmosphere, the Soyuz breaks apart. There's three main parts to the Soyuz. There's the service module, which has all the needs for the astronauts, everything from water to air to propulsion, solar panels to charge batteries. And then in front of that, the module that they're in, which is called the descent module, is called the orbital module, and that has a little bit more room in it. When they're in in orbit sometimes for a day or two. They don't stay in that cramped area that they do launch and descend, and they go into the orbital module. It has bathroom facilities, little places to eat. You know, it's a little bit bigger than, not much bigger, but a little bit bigger than what they launch in. Anyway, the orbital module and the service module separate all at the same time, and they all come back on the descent module through the atmosphere. And land in Kazakhstan. After landing in Kazakhstan, the Russians go on their way back to Star City, and the NASA astronauts, in this case, Frank Rubio, who spent over 1 year, 372 days. So now he's got the record. He took it from Mark Van der Heil. Mark had the record. I think he beat him by a week or so. So they're going to need to do this in the future if they ever plan on doing long-duration missions to Mars, but even to the Moon. You're going to have eventually the Gateway Space Station in orbit around the Moon, and where you're going to have a crew actually in orbit around the Moon for not weeks, but months at a time. Any comments? WS1. Okay, talking about crews going up, Artemis 2 is really getting their act together. Main core section of their rocket consists of four RS-25 engines. Each engine is powered by liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and each engine at one time flew on the space shuttle. Space shuttle used to have three of these RS-25 engines attached to the space shuttle, and they were all reusable. So whatever came back, they've refurbished, and they're putting them to work. In this case, Artemis is bigger, so it has four of these instead of three. What they do have in common with the space shuttle is the solid boosters. Space shuttle had two of them. They had four sections, going up, and on each one delivered around 3 million pounds of thrust. Port side 3 million, starboard side 3 million. Plus these engines, each one is 500,000. So shuttle used to have like 1.5 million pounds of thrust just with the liquid power engines, and now with Artemis, in this case Artemis 2, they'll be launching with four of these things, so that comes up to 2 million pounds, 500,000 each. And then starboard and port side, they're going to basically use the same type of solid boosters. The only difference is instead of four sections
complete.
Going all the way up, they made it longer. It's now five sections on the port side, another five sections on the soft side. Collectively, it's 8.5 million pounds of thrust, which is a lot more than the Moon Saturn rocket out. Well, they had five engines, but on those engines, they were ridiculously big. They called them the F1 engines. Each engine on the Saturn V was 1.5 million. Came out there. Roughly 7.5 million pounds of thrust, and this thing's going to be over 8.5 million pounds of thrust. And in fact, one was already launched. Artemis 1 had already gone at the end of last year for a 25-day mission around the Moon. This one is going to be sending astronauts all the way around the Moon as well. But it should be good. Four people that are going have... out of the four, three of them have ham radio licenses. So, Weissman, Glover, Reed, the other guy's Hansen. Anyway, they have ham radio licenses. And Christina Cook does not. Got to get her a ham license. Make it all four. Any comments?
Well, anyway,
Reed Weissman has a call letter of KF5LKT. Victor Glover is KI5BKC. And then Jeremy Hansen, he's from Canada, but he has an American call. A lot of the astronauts get their call letters down in Texas when they're training. But in his case, it's KF5LKU. When they transmit from the International Space Station, either private individuals on Earth or schools that have scheduled Aries contacts with them, they don't use their own calls anyway, so they use the ISS call, and ISS is what they use when they're in space on the International Space Station. So we'll see what they're going to do when they're on Artemis. I hope somewhere along the line they get to transmit, make some kind of a contact on the way to the moon or back. That will be a first. Any comments? WS2M. Okay, nothing heard. A couple other topics. Save them to next week. No problem. That's it. We'll be on tomorrow night. Tomorrow night is the club net. So I'm on the club net. And even if you're not a member, you can check in. They always look to check in to that net. And that's on these frequencies. And the time is 8:30. This net always starts at 8 o'clock. And that's always followed by Swap and Chop. George does a great job at that. KD2FYU. And then after that is followed by Amateur Radio Newsline. Anyway, let's turn it back to Roy. AC2GS. WS2N for the Space Net Report. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for all that you do on the Space Net Report, all that you do on the Technical Net, all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. I appreciate everyone who participates. Thanks for coming back. I missed you guys. I was away for 2 weeks. It's good to be back. So, once again, as always, I'd like to drop a couple of quotes. Dick, may rest in peace. K2RIW, who ran the show 40-plus years and did most of his technical nets along with the lines, be kind to each other. It's always good advice. And all you people, over 60, 65, please take your vaccines, take your boosters. It's time for it, and it's free, so please do that. And I'd like to mention good old Epictetus, the Roman philosopher. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows, so try and be open to other ideas and learn something new. Well, our rebels now are done. Have a great week. Please come back next Sunday, 8 p.m., when we'll try and do this all over again. It's been fun, I hope, for you. It certainly was for me. And as I close, once again, Slava Ukraine. This is the AC2GS going clear. Have a great week, guys. I'll talk to you down the line.
Have a good night, Roy. WS to win clear. Somebody had an open mic then.
6AZE, monitoring.
W2BL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
N2AML listening.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 4:55 a.m. Clear temperature 62 degrees.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 5:01 a.m. Clear temperature 62 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 6 a.m. Clear temperature 61 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 7 a.m. Sunny temperature 60 degrees.
KC2JRQ listening.